Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 14 continues. Her family had always had power and a taste for rhetoric. A gassy bunch, she thought to herself. She was even named for the daughter of the composer Gustav Holt, of all things. This made her a very funny kind of social worker. Money and privilege did not always combine to make stupidity, however. For example, there was one reason and only one reason that the St. Fursey, Minnesota Elementary School didn't have windowless walls like other schools built in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Her great-grandfather and her grandfather together had used force and money in 1970. Pure force, pure money. Old Cornelius Tenebrae, even so old as he had been then, and his son James had had money all their lives. Generations of money equals rhetoric, Imogene thought as she drove back north. Cornelius and James had bullied a venal school principal and his passive, startled and chicken local board of education into taking the architectural design those two men wanted instead of the more conventional design types being presented by a Duluth architectural firm. That St. Fursey Elementary principal in 1970 had been a sleaze, but not so bad a sleaze as the present man, Imogene's boss, Donald Menzies. In 1970, the school principal just wanted to do a favor for friends in Duluth. Laser Space was an architectural company that did a lot of schools. There was nothing particularly criminal in the principal's machinations. His meeting to publicize Laser School's proposal was announced, as it had to be, twice in St. Fursey's newspaper. Light refreshments, the announcement read, would be served. In that town, refreshments, without the word light, meant coffee brewed on the spot by the principal's secretary and fresh cookies from the St. Fursey Bakery. Light refreshments, on the other hand, meant cardboard boxed cookies from the Super Value. Laser Space sent their president and an engineer with drawings for the St. Fursey School Board to look at. The meeting was poorly attended. Schools are schools, and someone has to build them. The promised light refreshments protected the meeting ahead of time. As it was, one school board member in a Viking sweatshirt, whose obvious drunkenness said loose cannon to the principal, had to feel along the back of his intended chair to make sure he got his bottom into it safely. The principal decided not to worry about that one vote, but he was very sorry to see not one, but two members of St. Fursey's leading family at the meeting. Both Cornelius and James Tenebrae did attend. Cornelius was 81 at the time and couldn't hear much. It didn't matter. He was there to talk, not hear. James Tenebrae did not guide his old dad by the arm, but they entered the library meeting room with James very close behind his father, looking like an equerry who whispers cues to a powerful, aged king. The principal was a jerk, but he wasn't stupid. He knew a lost cause when he saw one. Still, once a meeting is set, you had to run it. He stood in front of the large newsprint stand. He thanked everyone for coming. He bowed to the two Tenebrae and smiled, though he had spent a restless night, fully hoping that neither one of those two rich bastards would show up on one of their goddamn power trips. He introduced an architect named Reg Glazer to the group. He also said they were lucky that Reg, everyone was first names because that was the climate, had brought his chief engineer with him. It meant the group could ask any questions they had, and one or both of these two smart guys would have answers. Everyone smiled. The principal introduced Reg, Laser's engineer. Then he said that without further ado, he would turn everything over to them. The Laser Company men took turns speaking. They carefully said that they were a three-generation family company. Lasers had been born in Minnesota for three generations, actually. While one spoke, the other laid fresh drawings and charts on the newsprint stand. They made a handsome presentation. They didn't recognize the Tenebrae, so they didn't jiggle their feet the way the school principal did. Like any human beings who have successfully made a business proposal exactly as planned, they were completely, sincerely happy to take questions. They nodded to the first person to raise a hand. "Yes, sir," Reg cried energetically, because the man looked very old and his suit was unmistakably Savile Row. Reg felt an element of relief as well, because he had noted that one of the locals present was informally dressed and looked drunk. He had been hoping that man wouldn't squeeze in the first question. His joy vanished in the next half second. Cornelius and James Tenebrae rose together. James brought forward a 3-foot-wide color photo of a very top-drawer building and asked Reg if it would be all right to set it on top of their stand. Cornelius started the talking. He asked everybody to notice the windows. He argued for expensive fenestration for the entire building. He asked everybody to notice the long, low building of one wing after another, with a short cul-de-sac of a wing for administration. The old man said to the board that they did not want a high-security prison to educate their children in. "Please," he repeated, "let's have windows." "True," he said. "Lots of brick and no windows was much cheaper than first-rate glazing and good interior space." The old man sat down. James Tenebrae had been passing packets of papers around, offering them between shoulders like a waiter with a hot platter. He did not forget the school secretary. Then he moved to the front. Using no notes, he told the board that cheapness was being wished off on them by the laser firm. "Let's not let them wish that off on our town," James said. He said, "Many of us will be dead, but our children's children will still be going to St. Fursey Elementary School. Let's stick up for our children and their kids, and so, St. Fursey, and St. Fursey, Minnesota kids to come." In general, the group let their mouths sag open. The Vikings fan made a thumbs-up sign. The younger Tenebrae reseated himself. The principal knew all was lost, but he wasn't yellow. What's more, he was very, very sick of being pushed around by Tenebrae's. That family even ran the church he went to. Just because they were Anglophiles, or whatever you called a UK freak, that church ran services that hadn't been used since they hanged you for stealing a sheep. The principal had been waiting his chance. He drew himself up and said, "That does look very expensive, Mr. Tenebrae and James." "It will be," old Mr. Tenebrae said. "It will take 2¾ millions. And whereupon his son James came forward again to the principal and then to the chairman of the Board of Education and handed each a large blueprint roll. "Here are preliminary drawings." The principal had a moment of hope. "Thank you," he said crisply. "You will remember that our board here is a fiduciary instrument of the state of Minnesota. We can't duck the question of the expense." James Tenebrae returned to his seat. He whispered to his father. He had rested one index finger on the table. Now he swirled it 30 degrees so it pointed to the board chair. His father nodded. Old Mr. Cornelius rose again. They all could see that it took him a minute to get the blood running through his legs so he could walk. "You're right," the old man said. He carried what people took for 2 small pieces of paper in his hand. He came forward behind the seated people again and handed one paper to the chairman. He brought the other around to the school secretary. The chairman glanced at the paper and then stood up at his place with a shining, obsequious look. He cleared his throat. He said, "Mr. Tenebrae has just given me an affidavit which I will read aloud to you. It will be the pleasure of the Tenebrae Family Foundation, jointly with Tenebrae Properties Limited, to pay 9/10 of the cost of the St. Fursey Elementary School's new building, namely $2,475,000, half when the work is taken in hand and the other half upon completion, excluding landscaping." It hadn't made news that much interested the VFW crowd, but it went along a route natural to its kind. First stop was the 19th hole of the Northland Country Club in Duluth. Reg Glaser had never been the club president, but he had taken one or another office from time to town. His detractors found it interesting that someone in some foxy little town called St. Fursey had finessed him. From there, the story mysteriously returned to St. Fursey. Next year, as the building went up, The school board members came to believe that they had pulled off something wonderful. They began to recall and repeat bits of the speeches of Cornelius and James. Sometimes these speeches were attributed to them, sometimes to others. Private money and family privilege had given St. Fursey Elementary a building with windows all down one side of every hallway and a huge picture window in every single office. Each schoolroom had a swath of window glass from 2.5 feet above the floor to within 2 feet of the ceiling. The only places you couldn't look outdoors from were the janitor's 4 supply closets and the lavatories. The smallest children could rush to the windowsills to see a bear family if it passed within sight. Teachers could and did interrupt their work with the kids to say, "Hey, everyone, look at that," because a stag was springing his does just within the forest edge on the other side of Tenebrae Creek. Now this autumn, a week passed after the conference Imogene Tenebrae had attended. 3 wolves trotted along near the side of the creek. Imogene got some cachet in telling a troubled little girl in her office, "Wait, a 4th wolf might follow after 100 yards or so." They both waited a full minute, then another. Then a handsome beast came slouching along at a slow trot, gray, low to the ground. November grew darker and colder. Imogene welcomed it because it discouraged the extroverted cheer that sunshine tended to build up in human beings. Other social workers had said there was no more futile exercise than agreeing to do psychological work with clients in California. They came to their first sessions full of cheer like expectant shoppers for in-season organic fruit. Took them 2 full seasons to get inside their own minds enough to concentrate on anything more serious than complaints about their mothers having given no help with menstruation. But the sunshine, the beach, the outdoor stalls of organic fruits and vegetables called to them to be happy the way they had been happy before. They often quit therapy at 3 weeks. A drawback to hallways so exposed to the outdoors as St. Fursey schools was that if you threw up in the hall outside your office, you could be seen by anyone in the front parking lot. Imogene's nausea attack on this Thursday morning came after Donald Menzies had spent a half hour doing business in her office. Imogene's policy in the 4 years since she took an MSW was to make it out to the hall for all vomiting. She was usually able to spare other people by clearing out of whatever room they were in, her office or the nave of St. Fursey Episcopal Church, for example. After Menzies left, his laughter, along with the sound of her own retching, was thick in her ears. He had fortunately turned the corner into the short administrative wing and didn't hear her. "Okay," she said aloud to herself as she went off to the familiar broom closet for pail and rag. "Okay, now you don't put it off any more. I will remind you," she continued to herself, but aloud, "you don't get to argue any more that you are only 1/10 crazed instead of 9/10 crazed. Your own 4 years of professional advice to clients has been to treat all lesions early on." Oh, but people can and do work these things out. A few thousand dendritic synapses in her brain said, "No, they can't either," a few thousand receptors said back. People, adult clients, had told Imogene they could work through their drinking habits if they had them, but they didn't do it. Other clients were going to work out getting the husbands to stop being a wife batter, but they didn't do it. But she was going to work through uncontrollably throwing up every time the death of any small child was mentioned. But would she do it? "But of course, unlike others, you are not crazy," her mind remarked glossily. "Look, you even heal other people." She reminded her mind that she had thrown up at the deck in Duluth just because 2 tenors sang a song about Abraham and Isaac. In St. Fursey Episcopal Church, she had thrown up during the reading of the second lesson on December 28th, just this past last year. And now, especially neurotically, she had thrown up because a principal, whose general coarseness she had been 300% immune to by now, had laughed about a dead bear cub that the cop had picked up. Her mind said, "So what's wrong with throwing up now and then? People do it." She firmly shut the closet door after rinsing the pail. "There's more," her mind said. "You can't even remember the name of your ex-husband's child. You really are crazy." Back in her office, shaken, she said to herself, "I will give myself 10 minutes to calm down. I might remember the name of Strog's infant son if I concentrate. I might. If I do, then I will work through the throwing up part later. She said it several times. Donald Menzies was such an appalling school principal. He was uniformly disliked by everyone. It wasn't even refreshing to gossip about him in the Denham Bakery, because everyone knew he was no good. Even Emma Jean's father, who felt some liking for everybody, had asked Emma Jean once if she had any idea why the bishop, a frequent visitor to the house, had explained, "So you're the ones got that fellow for elementary school principal now." Emma Jean had lightly said, "He was probably just referring to the fact that Donald takes the bad boys down to the basement near the lockers and beats their heads against the wall." "Surely that can't be true," her father said. Surely it was true, however. She thought there is no end to the way psychological street wisdom can be wrong. In her family, for example, her mother, being the alcoholic in the family, should by rights be, in all sensible psychological theory, considered the villain, the one who yanks around the rest of the family, so they are somehow to blame for her addiction. But it wasn't true. Her father was the one who wouldn't allow an affectionate thing to be said about anybody. Anybody. Donald Menzies. Donald Menzies and Emma Jean were so clearly enemies, they never argued anymore. He kept his eyes open for any chance to fire her. If the grown-up clients of the school's social workers were less likely than others to cost the people of the United States $34,000 a year for room and board at Sandstone or Dannemora or Leavenworth, that made no odds to Donald Menzies. What he needed was what he had built up carefully, a school board tending toward neutrality on all issues. He wanted them to be cross about tax paying. Their opinion of him depended on what they called his down-to-earth humor. When the question of the school social worker came up, he always repeated to them her salary, for which he would hint she did goodness only knew what with the kids that she shanghaied into her office. But then he would confess. What would he know? On her part, she watched eagerly for any eighth-grade boy who could get outside the culture enough to make himself accuse the principal of physical abuse, as in head-bashing near the lockers. This past Tuesday morning at 7:30, Emma Jean had come around the hallway in time to see the two janitors locking up her office. She found they had stood 3 5-foot-tall Title I files in the center of her space. No problem, really. In order to get them out, she first removed each of the 12 file drawers because they were heavy with paperwork. Then she was able to toe and heel all 3 tall cases out into the hallway. She replaced the drawers, and she sat down at her desk to look out the window at some pretty snow that lay as light as lace on the broken brougham outside. She estimated Vern and she would be together again in 9 hours, provided she didn't have to arrange respite care for anyone or drive any kids back to residential who'd run. She thought about bed with Vern for a few minutes. At 8:30, the principal found those gray metal cases standing right in the middle of his hall, where kids would soon be coursing past on both sides. He pushed open Emma Jean's door with a red face. She called to him pleasantly from her desk by the window. "Oh, yes, those darn things. Sorry, Donald, didn't know what else to do with them. Somebody goofed and put them in my office. I'm up to my ears in work, so I just took time enough to get them out of my way." "Nobody goofed," he shrieked. "I ordered those files moved in here. It's the perfect place for them." Emma Jean noted that he was actually trembling. That wasn't much, but it was something. "Am I ever glad you told me," she said, "because I was going to complain around until I found out who did it." He flung himself back out into the hall, striking and tipping one of the file cases against the second case. It made a 10-inch bright metal fuzzy edge scratch right through the khaki paint. The next day he burst in without knocking. "Sorry, Donald," she said, "I'm with someone right now. Can you come back in half an hour?" The child in her office looked astonished. Donald reappeared on Thursday, apparently not to sit down. He smiled easily here and there, picking up things, setting them down. He spoke very casually. "I'm afraid we are going to have to ask you to share the work that has to be done in our school." He studied one of her little animal statues in his hand. "Namely, 1, playground supervision when needed. 2, lunchroom supervision, but it wouldn't be every day. 3, bus checking mornings or afternoons when needed. Imogene got her mouth open to speak and then shut it. He said, "These little animals you got are cute. Speaking of cute animals, last Friday afternoon, I had to go to the station to sign for one of our kids as usual. There was the cop getting out of his patrol car. I had went over, and there was such a cute thing. For some reason, the cop had a dead bear cub sitting in the cage, sitting up looking as sweet as you please in the back seat. Its head had fallen over to one side, onto its shoulder, so it looked just like a kid who's fallen asleep in his car seat. I said as much to the cop. I said to him, 'Hey, Bernie, you driving bear cubs around so they'll fall asleep and take their nap?' 'Never mind,' I told him. 'Just kidding. This one you got here is not waking up from any nap. Yep, that baby bear is having the nap no one wakes up from. Probably a cub of that mother bear that people have sighted around town.'" He had rounded the corner before Imogene retched in the hall. She cleaned it up. She dialed that keynote speaker's number that she had been carrying with her since the MSS WA conference. A receptionist came on the line and told her he was with a client. Imogene said, "Will you please tell him this is urgent? Will you have him call me fast? I am in St. Fursey. Tell him I want to drive down to Minneapolis tomorrow. Please, will you get back to me on my cell? Here's the number. Please, tell him we talked at the Minnesota Social Worker Conference." The next day, Imogene managed what should have been a 3.5-hour drive in 2.5. She drove the whole way far too fast because she was driving with ingenuity, lighted up with the technical agility sometimes given to people when half of their common sense has cut out on them. The only part of the brain working noticeably at all is the triggering motor skills linked between thalamus and cerebellum and from there to hands and legs. Emotionally, Imogene was nearly out of it. She estimated her present IQ wavering around 79 or 80, perfect for risk-taking behavior in a car. She passed some I-35 drivers, obviously nearly asleep at their wheels, wrists hanging over the steering, eyelids lowered. She might be a half-crazed lady who finally got her head on straight enough to seek help because she needed help and now had found help and was going to the help and soon would be there. But at least she wasn't asleep, and if she killed anyone, she wouldn't have done it asleep, without noticing. Suddenly she was there, faster than Google Earth, better. Out of the car, inside the building, hovering near what had to be the receptionist's desk, in a room empty of people. Warm air moved about. The building's air exchange system gently hummed its tuneless voice. She listened to it carefully. Really, she told herself, this therapist's office was a pleasant, modern place. One really should try to live a pleasant, modern life and stay in touch with real things. Look, life was blessed. She had been too freaked. Why freak over something so small as vomiting? Of all the things people had wrong with their lives, and all she had was vomiting now and then. And why should she, Imogene, who thought she was so smart, keep gnawing at the old bone of whatever Strong had done with that little boy of his? That was his affair, wasn't it? And shouldn't Imogene move on? Moving on, she had been wrong. Oh, wrong. Moving on, she had been wrong. Oh, wrong. To object when clients made that gender-specific remark. I know I should let go. I know I should get on with my life. I know I should move on. She should have helped them. Let it go. True, only very badly licked women went for that phrase. But still, now that Imogene had taken a seat in a warm, soothing room, she wondered, who in the world had she thought she was?
You've been listening to episode 18 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the program's drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half. The piano music filling out these Shelter Half episodes is performed by Robert Ellis, our reader Connie Ellis's husband, from his CD, Moonrise.